Welcome to the Metaphysical Martini Show, where wit and wisdom come together to bridge the gap between the spirit realm and the physical world.
With Ani Avedisian, the Mad Shaman, a production of CosmicReality.com.
Hello, everyone. I'm Ani Avedisian. Welcome to Metaphysical Martini. Three parts spirit, one part rational mind. Add two drops of optimism, give it all a good hard shake and pour, dress it with the olives of grace and empathy. Sit back, sip slowly, and contemplate the wonder of cosmic co-creation. And a hearty hello to everyone out there. Hello, hello, hello. Thanks for joining this very crazy old lady for yet another round of cocktails on this week's Metaphysical Martini, the show that tries to sort out what's true, what's woo, and what gets flushed down the loo. In a world so incredibly surreal, where the whistleblowers are lining up to squeal, will we finally sort out the false from the real? Will people ever accept that they acted like Lucifer's pets? Will they take the necessary steps, or pretend they have Tourette's? Have the people of England convinced Starmer they're about to pierce his armor? And on a final note, a quote I found written on a tote. Why doesn't the British Navy bloody well intercept the frigging migrant boats? Welcome back, Martini heads. I raise my glass to you. Lovely to be with you again. If you're joining us for the first time, a warm welcome to you, a very warm welcome to you, in fact. But be advised, this show is politically incorrect so as not to erode the intellect. We don't do woke. We know the agenda behind the poke. We will never wear a face cloak. We are free thinkers and free drinkers who value common sense, common courtesy, common decency, and a well-mixed cocktail. We believe America has a sacred purpose to lead the world into the new golden age of peace and prosperity, into a higher vibration of existence, a realm of self-realized humans who understand the meanings of words such as sovereignty, accountability, responsibility, patriotism, honor, ethics, morality. A world populated by freethinkers exercising their God-given free will in ways that support the soul of Mother Earth, as well as her community of topsiders and inner Earth dwellers. Yes, folks, by now you might be thinking, ooh, these people are really out there. But I assure you, my darlings, we are very much in here. If the last 6 months have taught Americans anything, it is that your local conspiracy theorist was right about everything. It's downhill all the way for the nattering nabobs of Corruptistan. They will be housed at the Cuban YMCA in beautiful downtown Guantanamo Bay. Every cell has a beach view. The ablutions have been modernized to include, wait for it, flushing toilets. Catering too has been updated. Each inmate gets 3 square meals a day. Or is that 3 meals a day on a square tray? Yes, folks, this year's most popular destination for members of Congress is the Cuban YMCA on beautiful Guantanamo Bay. Room service and security available 24 hours a day. You will never again have to wash your own laundry, unless, of course, you are assigned to the laundry room. Large open spaces for walking meditation. Each step gives you an opportunity to review the events that led up to your incarceration. Comfortable, oversized orange jumpsuits with deep pockets. A perfect place to stash the smokes and tokes you will receive in trade for time behind the kitchen sink with Big Bad Bob and his performing mega penis. And if that isn't enough, The inmates just love to entertain newcomers in the shower room. Folks, come visit the Cuban YMCA in beautiful downtown Guantanamo Bay. Staff will gladly give you a full tour of the campus before showing you to your special cell, where you will spend the rest of your life wishing you hadn't become a greedy, money-grabbing, child-trafficking piece of shit. The resort at Guantanamo Bay. You know you deserve it. Well, my darlings, I'm not quite sure what happened there. I think I was possessed with the soul of some long-distant voiceover actor. What do we have for you on today's show? Well, as always, we have Quack, questions, answers, and comments, and that will be followed by a tiny pat of poetry, which is, of course, another opportunity for me to terrorize my audience with my assault poetry of very high caliber. We will also have a short but yummy segment of awesome American weird stuff. And as we always do, we will end the show with me becoming quite tiddled and sharing the recipe for the cocktail of the day, which is, you know, no surprise, my favorite part of the show. In fact, let's take a moment, ladies and gentlemen, to test today's drinky poo and see if it's a winner or a sinner. After all, isn't this the place where the Holy Spirit meets top-shelf distilled spirits? I think it is. Hold on. Give me a moment. This is a two-parter. How exciting. Don't go away, darlings. Drinking is happening. Sipping is happening. Ooh. Ooh. Oh, lovely. Lovely. I could live with that. You know, I could definitely live with that. Well, our theme today is demons and other dickheads, and that's always fun. So, you know, let's get on with the show. And let's begin, as we always do, with Quack. Questions, answers, and comments. If you would like to share the contents of your marvelous minds with martini heads across the known universe, send your emails to me, arnie@arnieabedissian.com, or by snail mail to Cosmic Arnie, P.O. Box 714, Wilsonville, Oregon, 97070, U.S. of A. And don't forget to let me know if and how you wish to be identified, or I will refer to you as Omit Personal Details. Let's shake up the fishbowl of perpetual perplexitaire and see what pops out. Shakey, shakey, oh, shake those papers, baby. All right. Our first email comes from Louise in Bakersfield, California, who asks, Dear Arnie, you rocked the Jeff Mara podcast. I did rather, didn't I? Ha ha, but thanks for mentioning it. So glad I found you on YouTube. And Louise continues, My husband says demons are misunderstood. He says they are not evil. They are lesser gods who traveled the stars and landed on undeveloped planets. What is your take on his theory? He does love to be right. Okay, I'm on the spot here because I'm going to save a marriage, ladies and gentlemen. You know, that's actually a good place to start the segment. So thank you, Louise and hubby. We do tend to think that demons are evil spirits or otherworldly powers that somehow have this great influence over human fate and behavior. You know, is that true or is that woo? And Louise also writes quite a lot about her marriage. Very interesting. I think you should both call me up for counseling. Anyway, she also said, I read elsewhere that 72 demons exist, but were caged by King Solomon. What happened to them? How did he get them? Did they break free? Like I would know. Oh, wait, yes, I am a erstwhile demonologist, or was. Let's see. You're talking about the goetic demons. Nothing to do with, you know, goats, really. It's from the Greek goetikos, which is a wizard. And it has sort of black magic and necromancy connotations. So the 72 demons that you're talking about, Louise, the infernal spirits, they are listed in the Ars Goetica in the Lesser Key of Solomon. Sometimes they're called demons, sometimes they're called spirits, depending on who translated it. Rather like the Bible, really. And, you know, they're connected to the 72 Kabbalistic angels and apparently are subject to them. For those of you who don't know, the Kabbalistic angels are the angels of the Shem HaMefarash, the 72 celestial spirits, whose names are derived from the 72-fold name of the Hebrew God, as per the book of Exodus. Stick to the plan, Arnie. No one needs to know all of that. All right. The story of King Solomon. There's a big story. He conjured up the demons. He captured the demons. This goes back, you know, a long time ago. And he summoned them. He summoned them using the special invocation. He captured them. He questioned them. And he put them into his service. And they all had different abilities and powers. And some were used as beasts of burden. Others were used for their intellectual capacity. Some were used in the propaganda department, whatever. But when he was finished, this is a story, people, okay? You don't really shouldn't buy into this. When he was finished with the demons, rather than send them back to hell or release them in the world, he did what every sensible king would do, I suppose. He trapped them in a brass vessel and sealed the vessel with his very secret seal to prevent the demons from escaping. And then he takes this brass vessel and he throws it into some nameless deep lake in Babylon. And it remains there at the bottom of the lake until treasure seekers find it and break it open. And then the demons are released into the world. And that's why we're in the mess that we are. And these are the people that rank the demons according to their hierarchy of hell. You know, kings, dukes, princes, marquesses, earls, presidents, a knight. And each demon has a number and all of this. You know, it does sound rather far-fetched. And while I do agree that all mythology contains a grain of truth, I don't buy it, but people love drama and they love weird paranormal stories. And that is why the occult history pages are filled with such nonsense. Where am I going with this? He wants to know if demons are real. Words change their meanings over time, you know, depending on who you ask. So is a demon an evil spirit intent on ruining human lives? Or is it just simply a spirit, something between a man and a god that can act like a guide? And perhaps they all have their own personalities and some are nicer than others and some have more patience than others. However, it is safe to say, though, that in today's world, they are associated with evil deeds. If someone says there's a demon in me, you know, it's not like, oh, it's a nice demon. It's a bad thing. So I'm sure that some of the ancient ETs were also mistaken for these demons. I mean, if a superior race with nefarious intentions landed on a planet populated by underdeveloped beings, and if that superior race behaved badly towards those underdeveloped beings, they might be classified in the underdeveloped people's history as demons. But they weren't, you see. They were just another race of humanoids or other species who, as your husband rightly pointed out, Louise, behaved badly. So if we look a little bit in history, cursory glance, because I'm drinking. In ancient Greece, a demon was a guiding spirit, possibly a deity, one that definitely could influence the work of humans. It was not necessarily good or evil. It was just a being with a job to do. Supernatural beings of a lesser rank than a god, I think is a good way to put it. But before that, right, I mean, everything's so Greco-Roman, isn't it? I mean, there were civilizations before that. If we look to the mythology of ancient Egypt, there are many things that might be termed as a demon. I mean, there was Apep. He was a weird creature, and he was the eternal adversary of the sun god Ra. You know, he was seen as an embodiment of chaos and destruction. So we would associate that with demons. The Mesopotamians across the road also believed that demons were not particularly inherently evil. They had a sort of a thing about it that they thought, well, demons maybe they influence natural forces that have an effect on humans. Maybe demons cause earthquakes. You know, that's how they thought of demons across the road in Mesopotamia. But then if we look to Zoroaster, you know, one of the oldest monotheistic religions in the world, I think that Zoroastrianism had a very big effect on our understanding of demons. So, this is an ancient Persian faith, and it introduced the concept of Angra Mainyu, the destructive spirit, which represents the essence of all that is morally and spiritually corrupt. I suppose a Christian would call that the devil. And this dark one, this Angra Mainyu, played a very central role in Zoroastrian cosmology, embodying the eternal contrast, the eternal opposition to Ahura Mazda, Ahura Mazda, which is the car that I drive, but also the supreme god of Zoroastrianism. So that's a faith system with a very stark contrast between good and evil. And that is what went on to, I think, influence the Abrahamic religions and, by extension, just about everything else. And if we look into the demonic beings of Hindu and Buddhism, in Hinduism, there are the asuras, often portrayed as sort of greedy little deities, the opposite of the devas, who were more benevolent. Not exactly a match for a Western demon, perhaps, but they did have a wide variety of traits, from being just a little bit troublesome to being absolute pieces of poo-poo, And then when we look at Buddhism, they talk about the hungry ghost realm. I love that term, the hungry ghost. That's what I'm going to call my paranormal tea room when I retire. Why didn't I think of it before? It's going to be called the hungry ghost. Back to this. So the hungry ghost realm, I think that's one of the six realms of existence in the Buddhist cosmology. And they believe that the hungry ghost realm is populated by beings suffering greatly as a result of not having balanced out their karma. So it's kind of punitive, kind of, I don't know, I don't know, I don't know. You know what I think? I think we use demons to explain contrast. Anyway, moving along, Christianity spreads across Europe, and the Greek word daemon, demon, became the Latin word demon. And we start to see this transition towards an inherently evil entity, that the demons are now, through the Christian theology and their understanding of what is good and evil, have associated demons just with evil. And now we really do just, in that faith anyway, regard them as lesser evil spirits in the service of Lucifer, Anyway, I think we can all agree it's a mixed bag, and very little in that bag is accurate. Because here's another thing. I see ET beings, I talk to ET beings, sometimes on my own and sometimes, with the help of a channel. And in my astral form, I see ET beings, extraterrestrial beings who I know are in physical form. And I've come across things that have a very high consciousness, but they don't have a conscience. They don't have a moral compass. And you go, well, how can that be, Arnie? That's not a being. That's got to be some sort of a demon. Well, it can be, I assure you, and they're not demons. They're fully sentient manifestations of source energy. They are their own race. They don't threaten or attack anyone unless they themselves are threatened or attacked. And if that happens, they are merciless, absolutely merciless. They will tear you apart in 3 seconds or less. But are they demons? No, in my book, of course they're not. They are a different race of beings who live by a different set of rules. I mean, demonology as an academic study is quite interesting, as part of history, a part of mankind's development. But honestly, what does it serve beyond that as we move into the new golden age? How many beings can we invent to blame our lack of accountability on? Who else can we blame for our gullibility, for our weak and easily manipulated minds, and all the sickness that we create in our minds and our bodies? Having studied this subject for far longer than was necessary, and having had decisive contact to this day with many malevolent beings, this is my meaning of what a demon is today. I need a drink. Hold on. Have a sip. All right. I didn't mean to go into all of that history. It just sort of came upon me. So I hope you're still there. When a human is out of alignment with its God source, it is akin to surfing the net without Norton or McAfee. You are open to all manner of bugs, viruses, and God knows what else, and no one can tell you for sure, in absolute terms, what anything in the netherworld is or is not. Look to the baser emotions and see how they influence us. These are the things that create the demons of today. Pride or arrogance. Well, of course, those things are absence where there is alignment and self-respect. Greed, as in covetousness, is also absent when in alignment, because in alignment, there is no sense of lack or limitation with which to feed the ego. Let us look to lust, as an inordinate or excessive sexual desire. You know, it has no place in alignment because the mind and the body live and work in sync. Pornography cannot corrupt the minds of those who understand the true meaning of love. They will find such images marginally repulsive and disrespectful to the God self, and they will not have them on their radar. What about envy? You know, that feeling of discontent and resentment aroused by and in conjunction with desire for the possessions or qualities of another. Again, lack and limitation. Can we be happy for our neighbor who just bought the Porsche that I had my heart set on but couldn't afford? Yes, the answer to that is yes, because he'll probably let you drive it if you like, you know, if he likes you. Gluttony, which does include addiction to drink and drugs. It does. Addiction to drink and drugs belongs in gluttony. You know, what are you doing? You're filling the imaginary void within the temp, you know, with all these temporary measures, all of which harm the mind and the body. And then, of course, anger, which back in the day they used to call wrath. The deranged anger is what wrath means. It's a forceful, often vindictive anger. You want vengeance. It's a violent anger. It's indignation, it's rage, it's fury, it's exasperation. But where is that going to lead you if you stay in that vibration? And then they call it sloth. I call it spiritual sloth. The ego's attempts to keep us from looking within and aligning with the God self, always making sure we are just one step away from success. All those feelings, all out of alignment with the true self, create vibrations. Those are thought forms. Well, the entire cosmos was created from thought, and eventually our thoughts created things. Think about what you are creating when you wallow in greed, lust, and pride. What will your deranged anger create? It will create angry thought forms, which will, if not cleared up, create some level of angry being, a little demon to peck at you until you go mad. My partner calls them the mosquitoes of your mind, and I love that. Louise, I may have gone off on a tangent there, but hopefully it was a purely demonic tangent. I hope that helps. 72 names of demons and all that stuff, that's academic research. The real demons are all in our heads. Okie dokie, here is another email from somebody called Ash, like the tree, you know, A-S-H. Hello, Ash. And Ash says, "Hey, Arnie, I saw you on the Jeff Mara show. Was Asur Banipal the king of demons? Did he summon Uruku?" I don't think so, Ash. He was a very important Assyrian king. And as far as I remember, he's responsible, or he has credit for listing the names of demons or evil spirits on cuneiform, you know, cuneiform tablets. Everybody has a different way of pronouncing it. And Uduku isn't the proper name for a demon. It just means spirits in general. So I would say Ashurbanipal was very literate, extremely bright. He's famous for the library. He had quite the library. He did, of course, commission his book on incantations. He wrote about, he commissioned a book about how to curse evil spirits, how to conjure them and what to do with them. But no, he himself, darling, is not classified as a demon. He was a learned man, an excellent mathematician. And if you go deep into occult lore, I mean, deep, deep, to unlock ancient dark magic, which does exist, you need to know how to run the numbers. The codes are mathematical. Ash, if you are interested in really learning about Ashurbanipal and not just in skimming over books written by people looking for quick sales, I recommend reading a book called History of Ashurbanipal, translated from the cuneiform inscriptions, August 24, 2018. And the author is himself, King of Assyria, Ashurbanipal. You can get it on Amazon. You can buy a paperback, but you can also download a PDF for less money. He is a very, very important figure in our history and well worth studying. Back in the day when I was really getting immersed in understanding the darker arts, his name came up quite a bit. I don't know why I said that in such a high-pitched voice, but his name came up quite a bit. All right, moving on. Thank you, by the way, Ash, for bringing that up. Perfect question for today's show. The next one is from FJ, who lives in Biloxi, Mississippi. And FJ, is it possible for a demon to enter a human body, throw the human out, and take over? Let me have a sip of my drinky poo. Guaranteed demon-free. Well, the short answer to that is yes. But the human stays in there, and that's the painful part. So you're describing possession, a full-blown possession where another entity takes over the body and the faculties and the movements, everything, takes over the host and has control over all aspects of the body. It is rare, but it does happen, and it is not random. On some level, the human has to invite it in. And we do that part best by being chronically depressed, by playing the victim, and by keeping an empty, easily manipulated mind. Many idealists fall prey, you know, to the quite often to the latter. We can't be tunneled vision, and it's good to have an open mind, but not so open that your brains fall out. But here's the thing, when someone is possessed by a demon, it is ugly. It's one thing to be possessed by a human ghost, because that's quite common, I suppose. There is a sense of familiarity, you know, human to human. But demons, whatever else they are not human. Humans, because of our sense of familiarity, can be reasoned with. Demons cannot. When demons inhabit a human body, they will attempt to act human. They will attempt to smile, to laugh, to do all the mannerisms that humans do, but they can't pull it off. And the expressions they form are grotesque and disturbing. When the human inside attempts to fight back and take control, and it will, that part is very unnerving. I'll share a story. This was quite a while ago, and I was maybe 22. I'm 66 now, so that gives you a bit of an idea of how little experience I had in the practical application of my craft. Let's just say a while ago, quite a while ago, I was asked to sit in on a police interview with a suspected serial killer. As it turned out, killing was the least of his crimes, but we will deal with that another time. And this chappie, you know, the guy in custody, he was relatively mild-mannered. And during the interview, he was cool, but cooperative. And at a certain point in the interview, it was about 40 minutes in, give or take, the detective questioning him left the room and left me in there with a large uniformed constable. Now, the man in custody was not handcuffed at this point, but he was very slight in build, unlike the uniformed constable, who was built like Goliath's younger brother. And all was quiet, and all was polite, until that detective came in with another detective, and something about the second detective triggered the demon within the arrested man, and the poop hit the pavement. I mean, grotesque, guttural noises. Spit and phlegm, flying all over the place. He even bit his lip and there was blood. And threats. He started making threats in a voice so deep. I have no idea how that little man's vocal cords managed it. And there we are. We're witnessing a war between the demon and the human, both desperately trying to gain control of the same body. Of course, the men were all into it and whatever, and I of course, just sat there looking unfazed because that's my professional look. But I assure you, I was phased. I was properly phased. But Constable Goliath and the recently entered detective grabbed him, subdued him. It took a while. Tried to cuff him while the other one, you know, left the room and said he was going to call a medic. And then this slight little man suddenly gained the strength of 10 men. And his face became contorted beyond recognition, and he lashed out physically and verbally, and it was all they could do to get him cuffed and on the floor on his belly. And then if that wasn't enough, he started yelling, I can't do the voice, but it was like, now you smell like me! Now you smell like me! And he kept saying that over and over and over again. And lo and behold, there was indeed a foul stench in the air, but it wasn't the proverbial stench of demons. Unfortunately, and most embarrassingly, Constable Goliath had soiled himself. And who could blame him? He had just witnessed something way outside his bailiwick. I won't forget that ever, I think, till the day I die. And it's just one of many stories I have involving the beings we term demonic. But, you know, these full possessions are rare. You can't be possessed or even attached if you are aligned with your true nature and you're in your right mind. Okay? So, darlings, let's take one more question today before we move on to poetry, history, and or whatever we're doing, and the cocktail. All right, this is from Joe, who lives in Portland. Portland, Maine. The other Portland, the other end of America. Oh, that's a nice drink. Okay. What does Joe from Portland, Maine want from me? Arnie, if everything is a manifestation of God, what or who creates demons? Jolly good question, Joe from Maine. Demons are created by misaligned manifestations of God in poor mental health. Mosquitoes of the mind, as my partner calls them. They drive you insane with their multiple little buzzers until you destroy them. And if you don't destroy them, they get big, or they get smart, or they get big and smart, and then that is a challenge. So yeah, everything is a manifestation of God. Even with the Luciferian rift, Lucifer is a manifestation of God. Everything, no matter how it was created, creates that original spark. And that is why, if Source Energy decides it's bored with all creation, it can press the divine delete button, and everything would go back into the islands of paradise, pure and clean, or shortly thereafter, pure and clean. Nothing would be left outside because there is nothing outside Source. And now, my darlings, it's time for a tiny pat of poetry. Yes, folks, after a hard day's shamaning, I like nothing better than coming home, putting my feet up, enjoying a nice cup of tea or a small drinky-poo, and writing amazing non-peer-reviewed poetry, because, my darlings, we can all agree my poetry is without peer, and there is a very good reason for that. This one is titled The Demon in My Head. I thought, you know, it would be appropriate for today. So here we go. There is a little demon who lives inside my head. He follows me around all day. At night, he comes to bed. I met him many years ago when I was very little. He had an odd ethereal glow. I gave him peanut brittle. We hung out at the candy store and hexed the gummy snakes. We called the neighbor's kid a whore and stole her Cadbury's flakes. At Yuletide, we stole fruitcake and cooked it dipped in batter. We added cream and mandrake and watched the diners spatter. I love my little demon friend. We have good times together. I hope our friendship never ends and that we live forever. What a dark and dastardly little demon. And even more dark and dastardly are the little human that accompanied him. You know, that poem reminds me of my corner candy store, or sweet shop, as we called it back in London, you know, back in the day. I remember we could get 12 gummy snakes for one penny, and I just loved those. In fact, I loved anything chewy. Now that I think of it, I might have been a cow in a previous incarnation. Who knows? Who knows? All right, my darlings, what are we going to do now? Hey, guys, because I am now co-hosting the Say What show with Nancy Hopkins and Jan Shaw every Saturday, I no longer have to talk about current events and politics and that sort of thing on the Metaphysical Martini show. We're going back to pure metaphysics, paranormal and weird shit. And huzzah for that. I'm so happy about that. I do hope, though, you can join us on Saturdays with Nancy and Jan for the Say What show, because we bring our spiritual angle to current events. And now for Wild and Weird American Stories. And today we will take a quick look at the legend of the Wendigo. Ooh, the flesh eater of the forests. Basil Johnson, who is a teacher and scholar, Native American, from Ontario, Canada, described it thusly. The Wendigo was gaunt to the point of emaciation. Its desiccated skin pulled tautly over its bones. With its bones pushing out against its skin, its complexion the ash grey of death, and its eyes pushed back deep into their sockets, the Wendigo looked like a gaunt skeleton recently disinterred from the grave. What lips it had were tattered and bloody. Its body was unclean and suffering from suppurations of the flesh, giving off a strange and eerie odour of decay and decomposition, of death and of corruption. Not somebody you want to meet on a dark night when you're trying to find your way home. So there's a legend that in Minnesota's North Woods, the forests of the Great Lakes region, and in the central regions of Canada, communist Canada, there is said to live a malevolent being called a Wendigo. And it appears as a monster that has some human characteristics. But some say it's more like a spirit who possessed a human and then turned that human into a monster. Now, historians tell us it's associated with cannibalism, with murder, with some sort of mad, insatiable greed. And it's known by the Wendigo, the Wittigo, the Wittigo, the Wittigo, Wendigo, any sort of variation of that. And each roughly in the native tongues of the region translate to the evil spirit that devours mankind. There's an Algonquin legend that describes the creature as a giant with a heart of ice. Sometimes it is thought to be entirely made of ice. Its body is skeletal and deformed with missing lips and toes. Other tribes describe it as a large creature tall as a tree. A lipless mouth and jagged teeth. Breath was a strange hiss. Footprints filled with blood. It ate any man, woman, or child that ventured into its lair. And those were the lucky ones, apparently, because, you see, sometimes the Wendigo could possess a person. And then that person became a Wendigo, hunting down those he had once loved and eating their flesh. So according to the legends, whenever a human lost in the wilderness has to resort to cannibalism to survive, a Wendigo is created. And this legend, well, there were a lot of such legends around when the Indians and settlers found themselves stranded, you know, in the bitter snows, in the ice of these Minnesotan North woods. You know, back in the day, without cell phones and without snowmobiles, you could be stranded for days, maybe weeks, and sometimes long enough to have to cannibalize your friends to survive. There are so many legends that describe gigantic spirits, 15 foot tall. It was once human, but then it was transformed through magic. You know, it's generally depicted with the big glowy eyes, with the dirty fangs, horrible claws, a very long and icky tongue. But it's interesting, the gauntness, the descriptions of its almost lipless. And they really are attributed with a lot of magical skills, but tracking is one of them. You know, stealth, they can become invisible, apparently. And they're very good hunters. Well, if you're invisible, of course, you'd be a very good hunter. Although I would imagine even if you're invisible, you stink. This Wendigo, Wendigo sounds very much like it would be smelly. But they know the terrain is what I'm trying to say. And, you know, there's all sorts of legends that they can create weather using black magic and all of this. And then I looked a little further, and apparently there is a term called Wendigo psychosis. Psychiatrists and psychologists know about this. It is an intense craving for human flesh, while simultaneously living in fear of becoming a cannibal. Is it true, my darlings? Is it woo? It seems plausible, but I know this for sure. There will be no backwards camping for me in Minnesota. And over the next few podcasts, we will be exploring various legends of American monsters and whatever. You know, I know that there's truth to this because, you know, you go to Siberia or some of the colder parts of Russia and, you know, up into the mountains of China and all. And there are similar legends of what happened when people got lost and they had to resort to eating each other. And they turned into these gaunt, weird, cannibalistic, semi-human, semi-spirit beings. This sort of stuff is fascinating to me. And I'm so glad we're going to be talking about this more and more on Metaphysical Martini. But as I look at the time, I go, my darlings, oh, my darlings, and all the assorted Wendigo people out there, I think that may be all we have time for today. I'm about to finish my drink, and that always means the end of the show. And I do hope you enjoyed listening in as much as I enjoyed recording it, because I had a blast. Why wouldn't I have a blast? Every other week, I get to hang out with my martini heads, my like-minded tribe, and we're all raising our glasses to each other. Big, big love to all you martini heads out there and to all the future martini heads contemplating becoming martini heads. This is a wonderful crowd of people. Now, I'm going to talk about the cocktail of today because, you know, it's not really a cocktail. I kind of cheated. I wanted to have a Boilermaker today, which is a shot of whiskey or bourbon washed down with a beer. But somebody gave me some Japanese whiskey and somebody gave me some Japanese beer. So today's real life cocktail is, wait for it, a Japanese Boilermaker. And I cracked open an ice cold bottle of Sapporo draft beer and a really good jigger of Suntory Japanese whiskey. And I have to compliment Japan. I'm going to test a few more of your whiskeys, but you have done an exceptional job with this. And this is just an entry level baseline whiskey at about $35, I think. Delicious stuff. Well done, Japan. Keep producing beer. And the Sapporo draft is absolutely yum-o-matic. It's just lovely. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Now, remember, folks, cocktails are great if they are an occasional treat. If you take the art of mixology seriously and use top-notch ingredients, one drink is all you need. I'm putting that ahead of the closing argument today because people have been writing into me today with, you know, telling me they've had a very difficult time and they've been drinking more and what they can do to, you know, to curb that. It's very easy to drown your sorrows, my darling. It really is. But I think what we have to do is stop drinking while we figure out the root cause of why we started drinking. And after that, I did that. And I promise you, once you figure it out, you can have the occasional drinky poo afterwards and all will be well. A big shout out to mysticalwares.com for graciously arranging the intergalactic distribution of this show. Mysticalwares.com, online or on location, you'll be sure to give them a standing ovation. I'm Arnie Avedisian. This was Metaphysical Martini, a production of Cosmic Reality Radio, to whom we are so grateful. Mwah, 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 mwah. Until we meet again, under no circumstances comply with any global medical directives. Remember that the news is rubbish and that all sides are lying about everything all the time. Be kind to pets and red squirrels. And above all, my darlings, let the spirit inhabit the human.
You have been listening to The Metaphysical Martini with Ani Alphadesian, the Mad Shaman, a production of CosmicReality.com.